The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I think without those reference points, you might be tempted to think of your brand of politician as having the country's best interest in mind. After reading both of those books, I think you'll look at all politicians the same way, as being incredibly self-interested and not particularly interested in what is best for the country.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, if you forgot when we were talking, let's just say I said that the Federal Reserve has just promised $60 billion a month addition to the market, a little bit like quantitative easing one, only larger. And corporate CEOs have the lowest confidence level, actually very, very low level, where they look ahead and they say, okay, 4% of us believe that things are going to be better in 6 months. When would you think I was talking? Okay, remember the $60 billion, the corporate CEOs.
2008, 2009, middle of the global financial crisis.
How about October of 2019? Yeah. I mean, those are the facts right now. We've got to talk about this. Powell says that that $60 billion is not quantitative easing. Well, what is it?
Well, we may think of, you know, present tense problems at Deutsche Bank, and they've had problems for the last couple of years. Or if you reflect back to 2008-2009 and the role that systemically important banks played in the global financial crisis, would anyone think about or reflect on BNY, that is Bank of New York Mellon, as a very important player today? That is not the topic for October 17th, for the tactical short call. We're doing our quarterly call, and it's at the periphery of the topic. We're going to be talking about managing short side beta in an extraordinary environment. But it is on topic today because you've got Bank of New York Mellon, who is the bottleneck of a $2.4 trillion repo market, the tri-party repo market. Just a few years ago, JP Morgan exited the business. They left Bank of New York Mellon, the sole provider of clearing and settlement for these repos, again, $2.4 trillion worth.
Well, and you're talking about just general liquidity to the short-term market. That's what these repos provide, right? And they're the bottleneck of trillions.
Yeah, wondering if all is well in the repo market is by default asking if all is well with one of the financial market's largest custodial giants, custodial in this sense, not being the cleaning crew of Wall Street.
Well, and speaking of CEOs, usually when the captain of the ship gets off first, the ship might be going down.
And I think, you know, you're referencing the CEO leaving Bank of New York Mellon here in the last few days. They're losing their CEO, and that may be an issue in months ahead as there's pressure which remains in the repo market, and you've got the primary player in that market searching for new leadership.
Yeah, but we've got the Federal Reserve. I mean, they can smooth out everything these days, can't they?
Yeah, and I think actually that CEO departure was for greener pastures. Fixing what's broken at Wells Fargo is, I think, where that CEO is headed. But you've got this context, back to what you said about the Fed, this is a context of concentrated responsibility with BNY. And it's easy to see how the Fed has stepped in to provide liquidity and may, in fact, remain in the role of market smoother. And we used to think of the Fed as it being involved as a last resort. Well, they're now the market smoother of first resort, not merely that sort of panic pinch hitter in the last resort.
So are they actually emergency body support or life support before the body ever even goes into convulsions?
Yeah, I mean, what they're really giving portents of is a permanent overnight repo facility. And that would shift the obligations and the risks in the money market towards the Federal Reserve, away from, you know, financial institutions that they rest with today.
What are the consequences of that?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, this is nothing new, because you've got what they've done so far, change monetary policy, begin to see unintended consequences from that monetary policy, and then backfill what was a marketplace role with a centrally controlled operation. And the New York Fed headquarters is right off of Maiden Lane. So it's the folks off of Maiden Lane who would be in control of this backfilled position.
Okay, but we've called these things for years free markets. It's no longer free markets. It's controlled markets. It seems that everything is now boiling down to more and more control.
I was going through the bookshelves here at the office the other day, and there was a few that needed to go, which is very difficult for me to get rid of any
books. It's hard for you to throw a book away.
No, I know.
Some of them you kicked right out the door, though. You couldn't believe they were still on the shelf.
I know. Some things that had sort of 5 minutes of relevance back in the 1980s, and you go, published for a moment in the sun, and that moment is long past. But I brought home a copy of The Law. And I brought home a copy of The Mainspring of Human Progress. So Weaver wrote The Mainspring of Human Progress, and I gave it to my oldest son, and he immediately started picking it to pieces because there's aspects of it which are so pro-American as to actually ignore some historical facts. So I appreciated that he was diving in with a critical mind, but I assigned both that and The Law to my 13-year-old and the 10-year-old. The Law is a must read.
Oh.
And
if it's just the first 10 pages.
To me, in this context of the Fed taking over more control in the marketplace, I think it's worth dusting off Friedrich Hayek's 1944 book, The Road to Serfdom. Kind of all three in a similar vein, but The Road to Serfdom is where Hayek convincingly argues that autocratic control awaits us. Whenever you have government or quasi-government organizations beginning to step in to play a role in the economy. And again, you may critique it as sort of slippery slope logic, either at its best or slippery slope logic at its worst.
Yeah, but then he did get a Nobel Prize, granted, 30 years later.
Exactly. So you fast forward to the 1970s, work that he did in the 40s was finally recognized as incredibly valuable. And I think it's required reading, as you say, Nobel Prize in economics. He's not a slouch. But I think this is required reading for anyone who cares about the intersection of public policy and freedom. And if you haven't read it, it's not an option. The Road to Serfdom is a classic.
Oh, yeah. No one will regret reading that. They'll actually regret then looking at the news after they read it because they realize we have really traveled a long ways down that road.
Back in college, I was the TA for U.S. history. And I took some liberties myself in assigning that in some of the side work.
Well, pun intended. Liberties. Liberties. We're talking about liberty here.
Yeah. And I don't know that people wanted an increased workload, but I thought they're never going to get exposure to this book otherwise.
Okay, so another L word. We had liberty. Now, let's talk about liquidity, because banks are at all-time highs as far as reserves that they're holding. How come we have no cash in the system? We're talking about repos, but really, that's just a fancy word for cash, and the Fed's been having to provide up to $75 billion a day at times.
It's fascinating, because this is an issue. Banks have a ton of reserves, but they have so little in cash. And so why money is not making it through the intermediation process to those that need it is a significant issue. And regulators, I think, will shine a light on this in the months ahead. But regulators seem to be unable at this point to ask the right question.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, pin the tail on the donkey. That's not a partisan comment. But what are the long-term impacts? What are the long-term impacts from playing with the natural rate of interest?
Well, Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun, but I would challenge that after 2015 because the zero bound on interest rates has been violated.
Yeah, and is that zero bound really that hospitable to the long-term creation of value? I mean, in front of me, I have Barron's and their weekly reg, October 14th, how to play upside down interest rates. And throughout this, they've got best income investments in a world of low rates. Negative rates are hitting home in Europe, 5 quality stocks with decades of dividend growth. And it's all, how do we cope with an unhealthy environment in the zero bound? Well, and it's unhealthy for the investor, not necessarily unhealthy for those who have tons of debt and are trying to finance that at low levels. But does this environment, does it spur these extraordinary low rates? Does it spur economic growth by stimulating investment, or does it spur malinvestment by spurring speculation outside your traditional lending channels?
Well, money's free. Money's free. I mean, why in the world would you consider risk if you could have more money anytime you wanted it?
Banks are unhealthy in Europe in part because of this low rate stuff. And again, there's a problem with intermediation. And we're asking the question, do these repo engagements that the Fed has committed to recently, does it suggest greater distortions and unhealthy functioning of the financial markets? Are distortions not to be expected also with the behavior of borrowers and lenders?
Right.
So we find things changing. In the case of nearly free money, what does it mean to measure risk? And how does the loan officer, what does he do? Is his role somehow abridged or curtailed? And again, we come back to liquidity. Perhaps liquidity has bypassed those that need it, the normal lending relationship with banks, and it's gone to those that want it, right? Namely, the leveraged speculative community.
Well, let's just unpack that. Okay, if you know that the money's free, why in the world would you not leverage and leverage on top of that? You double, triple, quadruple leverage because you really have no risk on the downside.
Hedge funds, private equity, grabbing cash to gin up results. I'm looking through, again, that Barron's magazine, and they're giving these cash alternatives for investors looking for fixed income returns in the 3-3.5% range. And I'm telling you, there's no such thing as cash alternatives yielding 3-3.5% unless you've brought leverage into the equation. Mm-hmm. It's become the vital component, not only for someone who's just wanting a plain vanilla cash product, but also someone who's speculating at the level of a hedge fund. And this is a sign of the times. Capitalism was once a system where surplus income was created and that surplus income was invested. Now we have surplus capital. It's not from savings, but this is surplus capital from the central banks. It's required now from the central banks. It's not so carefully invested. So back to the word that typifies the stage of the cycle that we're in now, malinvestment, non-bank financial firms. Again, these are your non-bank financial firms have a growing share of not only the assets, but I think also of the liquid cash as well. And they have a very different set of compulsions and requirements than commercial banks.
Do you remember, 20, 25 years ago when the carry trade occurred with Japan, where, you know, what you need to find is a country that you can borrow from very, very cheaply and then go make money in another country, make more money. That on top of leverage, you know, you also have currency risk, other types of risks, but there are great gains if you know that there's no risk behind the need for liquidity.
Yeah. So what you're doing is you're playing this game of low yield borrowing on the one hand and high yield investing on the other, and you're using someone else's money at the low yield, capturing the difference. So that's the nature or the, you know, rough description of the carry trade. And, you know, this is one of Doug Nolan's concerns, that the size of today's carry trade, whether it's cross-border or cross-asset classes, the size of that speculation, it is funded not by a singular country with low yields, but it's funded by free or nearly free money, and it's created a bubble that makes the mortgage-backed securities bubble look like child's play.
Well, and I think you need to repeat that. We're talking about the bubble that occurred, you know, 11 years ago, looking like child's play. That almost destroyed the world economy. Had the central banks not stepped in and bailed out the system, this next bail-in, Dave, is going to be huge.
Yeah, I think the negative implications are far more grave because the risk assets have been pushed up by these artificial capital flows. The artificial capital flows, they're from the U.S. market. You've got the Fed driving that. The Chinese markets, massive credit expansion from the PBOC, mm-hmm. which has fueled massive asset growth. The European debt markets, the emerging debt markets, Japan, everyone is playing in a world where, I mean, let's face it, sustainable growth is secondary. You want the immediate pop, the immediate return, and borrowing cheap, again, sort of with the low yield borrowing to the high yield investing, that's the game that's being played on a global basis, and all your risk assets are involved. All of your fixed income markets where that funding is cheap are involved. To see the interconnections within the financial markets is really actually a harrowing process.
And you leverage those gains because tomorrow you may die. I remember in high school learning about the philosophy of the Cavaliers. And actually, it was a verse that was taken out of the book of Isaiah in the Bible. But eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. Now, what we've got going is eat, drink, and be merry because we've got the Fed behind us. But it's still cavalier in its approach. And, you know, what it is a no-consequence mindset.
Yeah, this weekend we came to a similar conclusion. We were watching a movie as a family, and the director was trying to make a point. And it was really that at the end of the day, we have a nihilist and an existentialist conclusion. Nothing matters, therefore eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die.
Right.
And so
right.
We're doing that financially. Even while some of our directors are making movies and telling us the same thing socially. And, you know, here we find this irony because we have cash shortages in an age of excess credit.
But do we have cash shortages when we've got Powell coming in and saying, look, it's not really, let's don't call it QE, but it will be $60 billion a month, which is larger than what the first QE was.
That's where we find the Fed making new commitments. $60 billion a month announced last week. That's in Treasury purchases in order to ease the cash shortages in the financial system from this week, and I think they go through the end of Q1, I believe, 2020. This is a larger liquidity operation than QE1, but it's not. Powell was very clear in his opinion. This is not QE, even though it looks and smells like QE. Maybe we call it QE light.
But they're not worried. You know, they're telling us, don't worry about the economy. We're just applying $60 billion out of thin air.
Well, I think for the astute investor, you say to yourself, if the Federal Reserve is building a reserve buffer and creating liquidity for the big banks in a very aggressive manner today, is it possible that there are concerns that are not being telegraphed to the man on the street? Issues that they see, cracks in the financial system, which press them toward greater proactive involvement in the markets and ultimately, hopefully, with a positive impact for the economy. I think that's the case. On Friday, the Fed claimed that these actions were, and this is to quote them directly, purely technical measures in support of the effective implementation of an interest rate policy. It doesn't represent a change in stance.
Yeah, go away, kid. You bother me. This is purely technical. You won't understand.
But this is following Jerome Powell's comments that this is not QE. What is it then?
Right.
I mean, again,
right.
Maybe it's QE light, but the Fed is still, in addition to the $60 billion they're starting with this week, to create a little bit more cash for banks. The Fed's still providing up to $75 billion in overnight loans. That's for the repo market. Different deal. And an additional $140 billion in longer-term repo loans. This is the 6 to 15-day term repo loans. That's a different deal. An extra $140 billion. So Friday's comments, what they underscored was that purchasing of treasuries would, and again, he wanted to emphasize this is really not going to impact the markets. They said it's going to have little, if any, impact on the level of longer-term interest rates and broad financial conditions. And I thought to myself, okay, so wait a minute. They're saying that this is not going to impact financial conditions, just throwing $60 billion into the markets. A little bit of extra cash is not going to change financial conditions or longer-term interest rates. And, oh, right, what are they buying? They're buying bills. Bills are all short-term instruments. And yeah, technically, that's right. The impact is not on longer-term rates, but the purchases, what they will in essence do is help take away any concerns in the marketplace. Remember, we've talked about the removal of signal in the market?
Right.
What does the inverted yield curve signal to most people? You see the inverted yield curve generally just prior to a recession.
Well, and let's explain again, the inverted yield curve is when short rates are paying more than long rates.
And the purchases the Fed's talking about are going to help take away any concerns stemming from an inverted yield curve as short rates, again, this is the 3 month to 1 year, they have in fact been higher than your 2 and 5 and 10 year categories. So come on, isn't it fair to counter that claim with the observation that if you take away the concerns of operating with an inverted yield curve, you are, in fact, influencing broader financial conditions? I mean, this, in some sense, this is like a scene from The Wizard of Oz. Paid no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Well, and, you know, I just came from a meeting this morning before the recording, and Tony, if you're listening, I'll just go ahead and share the conversation. Tony's a pilot, and we were talking about the economy, and he said, so you mean to say that the economy this last 10 years hasn't really been sustaining itself? It's been stimulated. And I said, Tony, let me explain from a pilot's point of view. When we get to a stall angle on a plane, okay, you remember your stall training when you were learning to fly?
Sure.
You basically pull the plane up until that wing is right on the edge of not flying anymore and stalling. But now there's a trick that you can apply. You can apply power to the engine and you can fly for a period of time on the backside of that curve where the wing is no longer actually doing the work. It's actually the engine doing the work. And when the Fed, I'm going to apply this now to the market. When the Fed is stimulating by adding $60 billion more a month in new quantitative easing. Sorry, Jerome Powell. I'm going to call it what it is. $75 billion a night sometimes in repos. What we're doing is we're adding power from the outside that's not part of the actual power plant. This is not the economy supporting itself. We are in a stall right now, we're flying on the engine, and that always goes wrong because ultimately the fuel runs out.
Well, and note that the proactivity is right now in response to a slowing global economy. You've got the newest managing director of the International Monetary Fund this week says the global economy is now in a synchronized slowdown. And the reason why we are applying power to the backside of the curve, as you described it, is because not because of what we see in the U.S. economy, but what we see in the global economy. So all of a sudden, the Fed is now defender of the global economy, the world.
Soon the universe, by the way. Yeah, soon the universe.
I don't think anyone's made a cartoon with Jerome Powell in a cape, but that would be a fun one. Well, I think part of the pressure yet to be unleashed in the weeks and months ahead within the financial markets, specifically the stock markets, is in the tech space. And this is just kind of an overlooked thing, but the lockup periods for all of your recent IPOs, they're expiring. Between now, we've got a couple now within the next few weeks. This is the expiration of restricted periods where post-IPO, executives, employees, early investors cannot sell their own shares. You've got Uber, Zoom, Pinterest, they all fit that bill.
So there's a period of time when you are in that corporation that you can buy those shares for the IPO, but you cannot sell the shares for a period of time.
Not the day of issue and not for generally 3 to 6 months. So as we mentioned in our comments, Friday we publish each week on our McIlvany Wealth Management website, Hard Asset Insights, one-page summary, good read. The tech-heavy unicorn IPO space has become a disaster. And here in a matter of 30 days, you've gone from loss-making companies being the wave of the future.
Which we talked about. 3 weeks ago, we talked about how it didn't matter if you made money. You were going to get money flowing in from shareholders.
But from then to now, you have this refreshed view of profits and losses where you got to show investors money that you're making before they will throw more of it at you. That has been a significant change in the last 3 to 4 weeks. And I mean, to me, it seems like a modern day miracle that profits matter again.
Wow. Wow. Do you remember when profits started to matter back in the year 2000? Back, February before the March crash?
No, but you're hearing CEOs from Silicon Valley reflect on the change in sentiment in the last 3 to 4 weeks, and they're saying the feel is a lot like 1999.
Yeah.
I mean, everything was
working.
Wait
a second. We have to make money?
And this is the deal. And you had that eternally hopeful view that a company not making money would have preference because it's easier to fit it into a more imaginative pro forma.
Right. We
can go to infinity with this company. We can make more money than Midas. Granted, you can't calculate it on the basis of what we're making today, but that's why it's easier for imagination to capture. We can go anywhere from here.
Haven't you been to our office? We've got an espresso machine and Lincoln Logs and Legos. And why would we have to make money? We're a new innovative thought process.
Yeah, and that's changed within just the last few weeks. The Financial Times reports that 30 tech companies will move past the lockup period between now and year end. And in our view, the lens through which these companies are analyzed has been replaced with a harsher one where a sustainable business model is required and profitability is foundational. So again, you go back to the early private investors, the founders, the employees. They're going to want to capture liquidity that the IPO was supposed to provide, but with the SEC limits immediately following an IPO, again, typically 3 to 6 month period, there's a hunger to move to the exits. The likelihood of seeing tech unravel between now and year end is heightened by this sort of, call it a late cycle dynamic, where the market recently cared less about sustainability of sales and revenue, but now is expecting these attributes. You need to have some sales. You need to have some revenue. You need to, gracious, have an actual business. Those are attributes that you need along with a business plan. Sentiment shifts with expectations, and prices often follow.
You know, last week you brought up the bag holder theory. I remember when you worked at the brokerage firm and you had to find bag holders for the bigger investors. What's that look like now?
I think it'd be interesting to gauge venture capital sentiment at this point. If you went to Silicon Valley and the early seed funding, the angel funding for these firms, I wonder what their concerns are at this point. Because as you mentioned, we were talking about private equity last week, looking pretty late cycle with product proliferation for smaller investors, what we described as the late cycle bag holder theory. And I wonder if there's not a bit of panic in the VC community with the capital markets shifting from kind of who cares to no, we care. And from, you know, what need for profit to you don't get any more money without showing a profit. Again, for the venture capitalist, you're an early funder and the IPO gives you the exit from your original investment. The exits are to a degree closing.
It's not the consumer, though. We talk about bag holders, and a lot of times the man on the street is the last to know. Consumer confidence is very, very high, even though early in the program I mentioned that CEO confidence, the people who actually see the numbers and are just can't wait to sell their shares, they're getting out.
That's the interesting contrast. Friday's University of Michigan consumer confidence numbers came in stronger than expected. They're at a three-month high, and the consumer's not concerned. The consumer's not negative at this point in time. You know, never mind.
Unless they work for General Electric. Oops, yeah,
sure.
They might be a little more concerned.
You probably saw signaling of good times ahead there. just a little freeze on the pensions. Only 20,000 employees affected. Now, the reality is these underfunded pensions are a big deal for your staid old companies. Even with the huge run-up in stocks and the huge run-up in fixed income with rates near record lows, you've got the largest plans here in the United States still facing a $269 billion shortfall.
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling to me. Some are overfunded, some are nearly funded, and a bunch are massively underfunded. And when you look at that, you say to yourself, well, we can't keep on adding to these mountains of obligations without ultimately causing a crisis for the firm. And you just wonder if at the micro level, these decisions like GE freezing pensions, if that logic doesn't somehow flow upstream to government, where, again, the issue of sustainability, the issue of long-term obligations, the issue of cash flow, anything these things matter, or is the political animal considered to be somehow different?
I've got a good friend who worked for BP, British Petroleum, and he told me after the Deepwater thing, the concern that they might have that they would lose their pensions. Can you imagine? And I know this man played his cards right. He worked a good 40 years and retired, and he's got a good retirement, but there was that scare at that time that possibly it wasn't going to be there. Could you imagine working for 40 years in a job that you may or may not want really to call your life's goal, so that you could get a good retirement and it just possibly disappear?
And let's be clear, not all pensions are created equally. So if you are working with a state, a municipality, God forbid you are in the state of Illinois or Chicago, you know, that's a different equation than some companies. And there are some companies who are hurting. GE would be an example. And other companies that, again, are well-funded. So I think you have to be critical when you're looking at this from a company-specific standpoint.
But the shortfall is still $250 billion across the board of these larger companies.
Right. Well, so back to the University of Michigan number, because sometimes these numbers are particularly thought-provoking when they're contrasted with a divergent number, like the Conference Board's CEO Sentiment Index. Mm-hmm. From that group, we get the following. Taking this from the Conference Board's website, the Conference Board measure of CEO confidence, which was unchanged at 43 in the second quarter of 2019, declined to a reading of 34 in the third quarter. A reading of more than 50 points reflects more positive than negative responses. Mm. This is the lowest reading since the first quarter of 2009. When the measure was at 30.
Okay, 2009. Where were we in 2009? That's what we talked about at the beginning of the program.
Trade and tariffs certainly factor in. Where our opinion probably steps beyond the CEO stated concerns is that financial market conditions are unstable. Even with a resolution in trade conflict between the U.S. and China, which admittedly would help economic growth statistics, there are still issues within the financial markets which are very significant. You can't say that the problems in the repo market are tied to the global trade issues between the U.S. and China. Not at all. Now, there might be instability in the Chinese financial markets, and there's a knock-on effect to the U.S. financial markets, which shows its ugly little head in the repo markets.
Well, and we jump back and forth oftentimes. I think you should differentiate. You've got the financial markets. That's what we talk about with Wall Street and the banks.
Yeah, the contrast is between the financial market cancer and the economy. The former, the financial markets capture the reckless allocation of capital throughout this era of easy money. And the latter, the economy, what that captures is the consumer's circumstantial decisions and responses. And you can measure that in terms of the money that's spent in the system, right? So you can also measure that by the CEO sentiment numbers. I think it's worth lingering on that as a harbinger of corporate capital allocations, because when CEOs get nervous, what do? They look at their budgets and they say, gosh, you know, I just don't have enough visibility about where we're going to be as a company, the kind of sales we're going to have in first quarter of 2020 or the first half of 2020. I think we need to cut production back, or I think we're going to wait on the replacement of mainframes for the computer until, and all of a sudden these capital allocations get put on hold. The consumer is spending with confidence, right? Probably with less awareness or with less interest in global economic relationships.
Yeah, but they don't get a chance to talk to these CEOs.
Well, and that's where I think there's a difference here with the C-suite, your CEOs and your CFOs, et cetera. They're going to be making spending decisions based on uncertainty, based on concerns that do tie to Trump and Xi and the broader decline in global trade. Out of this group, you mentioned it earlier, only 4% of CEOs see an improvement over the next 6 months. 67% expect economic conditions to worsen. Not surprisingly, we've got the major number of these CEOs, about 64%, expect to see a decline in sales and a decline in revenue coming into 2020.
Yeah, but the stock market doesn't show that. The stock market says everything's just going to keep getting better.
That's right. What is priced and what is not priced into the S&P 500 or the Dow, the S&P is now near 3,000, the Dow roughly 27,000. And again, you've got expectations of these CEOs, declining sales, declining revenues, a tough economic environment moving forward. This is a significant divergence of opinions between the consumer, the man in the street, who's just happy to buy, happy to enjoy, happy to indulge, and the CEO who says, I don't see it. I don't like what I see.
Well, you said last week they're liquidating. The CEOs are actually liquidating their own shares. It's called insider selling. And at the same time, they're borrowing money and buying up their own shares to boost the share price.
In some instances, borrowing to buy the share buybacks. In some instances, just using cash or part of free cash flow for the buybacks. So buybacks utilize company cash. Those are raging ahead. Insider liquidations of company shares, you know, those liquidations are raging ahead. And the CEOs are telling you. They're telling you both by their actions and with, you know, the poll, the measure of CEO confidence, the conference board numbers, that trouble's coming.
You know, most people don't have a lot of savings. When you look across the board, across the nation, if a person owns their house, it's usually the largest part of their savings. So let's look at the housing market, because that seemed to be the fly in the ointment back in 2007, 2008, 2009. Where are we at right now, and what are interest rates telling us?
Yeah, and you know, the wealth effect was something that the Fed targeted. They wanted to buoy not only stock returns and whatnot, but also housing. Because housing is a factor into the general sentiment for the consumer, probably more than the CEO. But, you know, you feel good if your home is worth more than it was last year. And you might even tap some of the equity to make some improvements and, you know, add this or add that or even take a vacation. A year ago, we were at an inflection point in the mortgage market. We were at 4.9%, just peering into the fives for the 30-year fixed rate. And that's if you're a good credit. Now, we're down 133 basis points. Your 30-year fixed rate mortgage is at 3.57%. Tell me that doesn't factor into the consumer's feel-good moment right now, captured in the University of Michigan sentiment measures.
Okay, but we were at 4.9% last year, and I know you were concerned that once we broke that 5% barrier that there may be a change.
I think it is. I think that number is the Rubicon for consumer borrowing and housing market stability. Cross it, and pain will be triggered. So at this point, the consumer here in the U.S., feeling no pain, not a concern in the world.
But we've talked before that the consumer in the U.S. is definitely not where you want to get your clues as to how things are going. It's better to watch, oh, I don't know, maybe the Chinese, maybe the Russians, maybe the Turks, maybe the European central banks. Sometimes those are where we should get our clues. You know, do as I do, not as I say.
I was fascinated by that conversation I mentioned last week with the endowment partners and the consulting that we do during the month, so that the college here in town.
Yeah, how'd that go?
It was good. There's some messaging that's just going to fall on deaf ears, and there's some that I think I can, I don't know. Hopefully I add some value there. But it's interesting, the concerns, the level of concerns, very different. Consumer is obviously spending because there's confidence and sort of a spring in the step. In that room, there was more pessimism and negativity and discussions of moving to New Zealand because the Trump administration is an abomination. Just like to many in the previous administration, Obama was an abomination. I mean, you go from one period to another, and you've got one group who is just tearing their hair out right. and convinced it's the end of the world. And then it's the other team's turn to tear their hair out and think it's the end of the world. To me, I have a low opinion of politicians and of this back and forth, kind of a kabuki theater, power games without any real focus on values and getting a good job done.
But both sides like to spend an awful lot of money, and they'll tell you why it works for their side.
Well, they do. So where we see clues is, you know, you see central bank activity. This is one of the things that they wanted to talk about. Central bank activity and the purchases of gold send a very different message.
Yes.
You know, if all is well, stock market says all's well, and confessions of all around the table, with the exception of me, that the efficient market hypothesis is alive and well.
It must work.
Market knows something that we don't. You've got the Dow and the S&P at high numbers, but we're concerned about this political disaster.
Well, forget that the People's Bank of China is buying gold. Forget that the European central banks are buying gold with both hands.
And that's, I think, worth keeping in mind. Bloomberg reported the latest inflows into gold by the People's Bank of China, 5.9 tons. That was the most recent addition. That follows 99.8 tons over the prior 9 months. And yeah, so what do they see?
Yeah.
What do they see here? When they're buying gold and fortifying a reserve position, is that because they see a positive outcome in the trade conflict? Is that because they see potential for devaluation of the RMB? And the reality, which all central bankers have recognized through the decades, that if you have a collapsing currency, the only way to reestablish credibility is to bring gold back into the conversation, if not the literal monetary equation. And so what are the Chinese doing? I think we know where the RMB is headed over the next 6, 12, 18 months. The pressure's there, and the likelihood of devaluation are pretty high.
Yeah, and they're not speculating on price. We talked last week that they just add to their buying anytime gold goes down. We're in a little correction right now.
I would like to buy 5.9 tons this month.
Yeah.
Somehow that would bring me great satisfaction.
Well, okay. So going back to politicians always spending money. Okay, let's just take the partisanship out of this for a moment, and let's look at what the deficit's going to be this year.
Well, the partisan divide grows by the day. And I'm curious if you can tell me what Donald Trump has in common with Nancy Pelosi, with Mr. Schiff, with Schumer, Elizabeth Warren.
We're going to lose half our listeners. They're going to turn over to Glenn Beck or someone else because you can't put him in the same camp as Warren or Schiff.
What does Donald Trump have in common with Elizabeth Warren, Schumer, Pelosi, the whole bag?
This is like Sesame Street. Remember that? Three of these things belong together.
Yeah.
Three of these things are kind of the same.
Well,
keep going.
Washington, D.C., I think it makes for strange bedfellows. The federal budget deficit for 2019 is projected to be $984 billion. And, of course, actual financing needs will exceed that by another $200-300 billion.
Right. Yeah, they break a trillion. They just call it different things.
Right. So maybe more. Again, we're talking about projects that no one wants to talk about. It doesn't get fit into the budget. But then throw on top of that the evergreening. You got a few hundred billion dollars in debt.
What's a few hundred billion?
Ah. And so that the $984 billion figure, that is the highest since 2012, according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Hmm.
And what I'm saying is the actual deficit figure is likely 50% above that. But back to the question, what do politicians have in common when you set aside this or that coup attempt or whatever else? What binds all politicians' hearts together? This is from a Bloomberg story. Steve Matthews wrote this up. He says, U.S. budget deficits and the national debt are on track to keep growing because both Donald Trump and his Democratic rivals want to use low interest rates to finance more spending.
Right.
In effect, embracing some form of modern monetary theory.
Right. And so, I mean, even Trump tweeted, you know, 3 weeks ago that he'd like to see us go to negative interest rates. Well, what's that saying? That's exactly what you're talking about.
Truth is of secondary importance when power is on the line.
Right.
And I think that's what we see is, if you're looking at the news media, this is probably, just to clear aside partisanship, truth becomes irrelevant when power is on the line. And the power of the purse has never been more important, because right now you have the promise of limitless spending, which has just been theoretically rationalized. We're talking about modern monetary theory. And so he who controls the purse controls limitless spending and controls, in essence, limitless power.
Well, MMT, okay, $60 billion a month by Powell, and let's don't call it QE because it's just simply technical. Again, go away. Go away. You bother me.
Well, and what we've talked about in recent weeks is we actually are in a transition, even though Powell holds on to quantitative easing and expansion of the Fed balance sheet and some measure of monetary policy shenanigans, we still have the fiscal drum roll playing, because we will have announcements of how money will be spent. It's money that we don't have, but how money will be spent. As Americans, again, set aside your partisan views, as Americans, we should recognize this period as one of our greatest national risks. Politicians on both sides of the aisle are destroying the fabric of society. They're reshaping the capital markets, and they're creating greater political animus than we've seen since the 1860s. So that the winner, and there only be one winner, everyone else is a loser, so that the winner can take all. And the body politic is being risked for the sake of collapsing political power into a single party system.
So the phrase is, give me liquidity or give me death. Give me liquidity or give me death.
I think Ben Franklin knew the cycle. And we're not talking about the business cycle or the economic cycle, but the political cycle, from freedom to bondage. When he said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become more corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. Kevin, what's changed?
This goes back to the three books you recommended. And actually, I'm going to reduce that to two. Okay. Hayek is absolutely necessary. And The Law by Bastiat is absolutely necessary. Mainstream of Human Progress is interesting, but again, it's hyperbolic in some ways.
It is very much so.
But Hayek is not. Road to Serfdom is not. And neither is The Law.
Now, so your assignment, should you choose to fully engage here, is to carefully read The Road to Serfdom by Hayek and The Law by Bastiat. I think without those reference points, you might be tempted to think of your brand of politician as having the country's best interest in mind. After reading both of those books, I think you'll look at all politicians the same way, as being incredibly self-interested and not particularly interested in what is best for the country.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, or you can call us, and thank you, many of you did this week, at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.